These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled Classic Novels, Meeting the Challenge of Great Literature, Part 2. Lecture 13, Dickens, Bleak House, Part 2.
When I was lecturing on Balzac's novel, Père Goriot, I mentioned the fact that the word visionary had been used, and in particular it would apply to a scene late in that book when the student has a double image of this elegant ball, this reception being given, and this poor man Goriot dying in a garret. And I want to suggest that that vision of connectedness, that double vision, which might be visionary in Balzac, becomes an absolute structural principle in Dickens and in Bleak House. That although the erotic whodunit, who is Esther's mother, etc., initially commands our attention in reading this novel, gradually we understand that it really is a more ambitious story still, which entails a new kind of vision of the world, of interconnection, a tentacular vision in which people find, usually to their amazement or horror, that they are connected to, perhaps glued to, perhaps part of somebody else. Now, the erotic material is fascinating. I say erotic as if Dickens were erotic. Let's just call it the amorous attachments. And certainly the long-awaited revelation of Esther's status as the illegitimate daughter of Lady Dedlock sends shockwaves along social lines, and Dickens is good at making sure that we get just the fullness of all of this. And in particular, towards the end of that book, we see Lady Dedlock fleeing the Dedlock Manor, in part because Tulkinghorn, the lawyer, who has now fully understood her secret about the liaison with Hawden Nemo, is about to expose her, and to prevent him from doing that, she leaves. And she makes her way, I think, in a quite provocative fashion, because it means so much for the logic of this novel, right to the slum, Tom All Alone's, which is the slum where Hawden is buried. And Esther follows her. Well, that pursuit of Lady Dedlock to the slums merely underscores that the slums are, in a sense, the magnetic center of this book, that even more than in Balzac's novel, Père Goriot, Bleak House is going to tell us something about new lines of coherence, new patterns of belonging, or what I'm really getting at, is a new model of family altogether, perhaps even a model that we could call brotherhood and sisterhood. I'm going to digress for a minute and tell you a little anecdote that the writer Carlyle once mentioned, which has to do with a woman who was dying in Edinburgh, dying of typhus, and she walked from house to house begging for help and for sustenance and was telling people that I am your sister. You must help me. We are bone. I am bone of your bone. You must help me. And they looked at her, Carlyle writes, and they said, no, you were no sister of ours. And the story closes by Carlyle writing, or he's actually quoting another writer, that she died of typhus and infected and killed all of them and thereby proved her sisterhood. And it's in that sense that the kind of family that is going to get revealed here is not some happy, cozy affair that has anything to do with soft, mushy family values. There's no sentiment involved in it. It's much more muscular. It's steely. It's a rather lucid, larger angled picture of how we are connected beyond our understanding, beyond our kin. Kin, K-E-N, not K-I-N. And I'd suggest to you that in some sense, it's that connection, which we cannot see with our eyes. We're not equipped to see it. The people in Edinburgh were right to say, you're not our sister. Who are you? We don't know you. She proves her sisterhood by infecting them. You cannot see infection. And maybe not only medical diagnosis, but perhaps literature itself helps to sensitize us to these kinds of invisible umbilical cords which relate us to others. And in that light, the central relationship in this novel, in my view, is not between Lady Dedlock and Esther, the long-hidden, finally exposed, illegitimate mother-daughter relationship, but rather the one where there's no blood kin whatsoever, which is the relationship between the orphan of the slums, Joe, the illiterate orphan who cannot read, who lives in a world of mystifying signs that he can't decode, the person who says, I don't think nothing, N-O-T-H-I-N-K, and our heroine, Esther Summerson. Joe, as I indicated earlier, is employed, if we can use that word, as a street cleaner, more or less. I mean, he sweeps away the path through the mud so that the more well-to-do people, the healed ones, well-heeled ones, can cross and make their path. And he's not allowed to stay in any place too long. One of the refrains of the book that he keeps hearing from the constables is to move on. He is the most abused person in the novel, it seems to me. He has no home, has no family, has no funds. He has only one friend, we're told, and that's Nemo Hawden, who's dead. He were nice to me, Joe remembers. So Joe becomes ill, not surprising, given that he lives in the neighborhood of the great slum, Tom All Alone's, and that he has no resources whatsoever. And he flees London, and he ends up at Bleak House, where John Jarndyce is living with Esther and Rick and Ada. And when he arrives there, Esther's maid, Charlie, she's a girl with the name Charlie, tends to him. She helps take care of him. All they know is that he is sick, he's shivering, he's cold, he's got fever. And it turns out that he has virulent smallpox, which Charlie catches. Esther then tends to her maid, Charlie, and she too contracts the smallpox and is disfigured. This is the story of family. This is the story of human relation. You can say, well, wait a minute, this is just a story of infection and contagion. But then you would be getting the short end of the stick. You'd be seeing it from the narrow angle. Because what I think Dickens is trying to point out is that this is the larger brotherhood, sisterhood that disease always signifies. Let me read you the really quite striking way in which Joe's exit from London, his coming to Bleak House, his infecting Charlie, and then his disappearance is written. They come to see if he's still there the next day. They don't yet know that Charlie is infected. And Dickens writes, as they're looking for the boy, and this is Esther trying to find him, "It's the boy, miss," said he. This is somebody speaking to Esther. "Is he worse?" I inquired. "Gone, miss." "Dead? Dead, miss?" "No. Gone clean off." Now, the title of another little chapter is called Stop Him. And the reason that I cite this is to say that Joe cannot be stopped, but he can be caught in the sense that his smallpox is caught. It's caught by Charlie and then by Esther, so that the line, gone clean off, couldn't be less true. And it's in that sense that we begin to realize that this is a story, as I said, that is tentacular, where the umbilical cords between people are far more numerous than we might imagine. Esther's own gathering relation to Joe, the orphan, is always written by Dickens as a challenge to Esther's sense of self. So that when Esther is going to meet Joe at one point, Dickens writes, from Esther's perspective, "I had for a moment an undefinable impression of myself as being something different from what I then was." It's a kind of interesting intuition. I mean, obviously, this is planted in the book by a writer who knows what is to follow. And yet, it strikes at our notion of our own sort of integral self-knowledge. And it says, no, it's not integral. It's not complete. That you're missing much information. That you were connected and bonded in ways that you cannot yet know, but that life will teach you. And that's what's going to happen here. That as she acquires the sickness herself, we are beginning to see that her whole self-definition is changing. At the risk of making it sound like a crazy analogy, think back once again to the Oedipus. I said that the backdrop of that story is plague, which is infection that connects people that didn't know they were connected. And then think to the front story, which is a man who is rediscovering who he is, recharting and replotting his own narrative line. And I want to say that these things are not separated entirely. One has to do with the other. The story of epidemic, the story of plague, the story of disease inevitably entails a redefinition of the human subject, of the human person, of you and of me. We rethink our own boundaries. We rethink our own contours. That's exactly the way he's going to write Esther here. When Esther is feeling poorly because she's contracted this from Charlie, who's gotten it from Joe, and she doesn't yet know what it is, Dickens writes, "I felt confused at times with a curious sense of fullness, as if I were becoming too large altogether." It's as if she is bursting, not just, I think, with disease, but bursting with a sense of becoming more than Esther. Or let me rephrase that. It's as if this were a form of birth, that she is big with, pregnant with, something larger than herself, that she's coming to know through disease. And I have to say, there is no pleasant way to experience these things in Dickens, and perhaps not in life either. The connectedness that this book talks about is not some chummy little affair of saying, oh, I really love other people, or oh, I write out a check to charity every month, or I give to beggars whenever I see them. It's much grimmer and more visceral and more demanding than that. You experience it in your flesh. The Germans have a marvelous phrase for understanding, auf dem Leibe erfahren, to experience it in your flesh, with the corollary being, if you haven't experienced it in your flesh, then you don't know what it means. You haven't really experienced it at all. And I think Dickens's book is tough along those lines. He's easily misconstrued as a kind of sentimental Victorian writer. That won't do. It won't tell you what's going on. And so she gets the smallpox full, head on, and she is disfigured. And it's hard to sort of measure how much that must have meant. And she goes blind for a while, and she experiences remarkable pain. Listen to the way she describes the pain. "Dare I hint at that worst time, when, strung together somewhere in great black space, there was a flaming necklace or ring or starry circle of some kind, of which I was one of the beads." To me, it's one of the most brilliant passages in the entire novel. The reference to necklace and ring, it's a splendid reference, because if we think of it on the cheap, we say, ah, a frivolous reference to all of the finery that her aristocratic mother, Lady Dedlock, has, the world of gentry and the well-off. And then we think for a minute, structurally, what is a necklace or a ring or a starry circle? It's some larger shape, some larger constellation in which you find not that you own it, not that you wear it, not that you possess it, not even that you see it, but that you are a component of it, a piece of it, an ingredient of it. Bye-bye agency, bye-bye hegemony, bye-bye control. This is your discovery that you are a cog in the system, a cipher in the system, a piece of the system, which again along ecological or environmental lines says you are a part of a larger family, brotherhood, sisterhood. That is the lesson that disease, smallpox, is teaching Esther in this book. I earlier said that Esther's disease could be construed, if you wish to, as a kind of sexual punishment for the transgressions of her mother. Sometimes when I'm in a more cynical mood, I believe that Esther, who can be impossibly cloying and goody-goody at times, I feel like, well, Dickens himself must have had enough, and so he smites her with smallpox. But I don't think Dickens was really capable of that, at least not consciously. Because you got to say that at some level, after all, Dickens wrote these pages, at some level, this novel is giving Esther a hard time. It's disfiguring her. It's taking away her beauty. It's subjecting her to incredible pain. It is initiating her into some larger family. This isn't pleasant. It isn't fun. And yet there's something remarkably grand about it. She's being reborn. She loses her control. She loses her old face, altered now. She loses her old confining boundaries. What an amazing notion that a person could be reconfigured. I mean, we talk about the stages of our lives. We talk about passages and growth. Yet every time any of us looks in the mirror, even if we see more wrinkles or white hair or less hair or whatever, we still recognizably see the same person that we've always been. But we know that searing experiences, that terrible trials do change us and alter us. They can be religious, they can be emotional, they can be moral. And we can't see these things easily. They're not available to the eye or to the retina. I think Dickens's book is out to chart that. It's out to give us a fuller sense of the evolution of a human being, of what moral growth might really mean, of what human responsibility might mean, of what spiritual citizenship might mean. And each of these terms is tough because it redefines who you are and it positions you in a larger framework where you have no control. Well, that, it seems to me, is what is happening to Esther in this book. And that's why when I said initially in my first lecture that something is rotten in the state of England, and I said that rotten has to do with medicine as well, with disease, it's because this is a book about disease. It's about disease as a familiarizing force. Disease as a force that utterly challenges and alters forever our sense of who we are, where we belong, who we might belong to. And so this is a book that is a fluid book of linkage and connection. That's what starts to become readable and visible in a story of epidemic or plague. Infection changes our sense of our contours. A word that I've already used, and now that I will come back to, is the word pollution, because it's of a piece with the logic that I'm talking about. What is pollution? Pollution, again, utterly challenges our sense of our own closed self. This is so counterintuitive for most of us, even if conceptually we know that it may be true. Again, think of the mirror or just use your eyes and you look at your hands, the extent of your fingers, your body, your toes. How can you not think that that's where you stop? That you are the person born in that body and you're going to die in that body. How can you not think that it's a fairly closed proposition? And we know what happens when the body is opened. If we're wounded, if something punctures or penetrates us, we know that this is a great threat to us. And that's a kind of invasion that is easy for us to understand. What is harder for us to understand, but even more significant, is the way in which we are invaded, infiltrated in other ways. How porous we are in other ways. We are porous ideologically. We are porous emotionally. The world comes at us through waves. It comes at us through images. It comes at us through speech, through things that we have heard from our parents, that we've heard in church, that we've heard on television or radio, that we've heard even read in the papers. All of these things have a kind of, they're like waves. They go through us. We are not some membrane that can keep the world at bay. Dickens's world is constantly cued to that, that his people are interable, invadable, permeable. And I want now to say that is the condition of human beings in culture. It's not just a medical notion. All of us are influenced and altered and formed and shaped that way. I earlier used a phrase that is one of the darling phrases of modern theory, which is that subjectivity is constructed. And that's what those people mean. That we think that what we are is some sort of innate person, whereas in fact it may be the case that we are the product of all kinds of things that have come through to us. This book, Mid-19th Century, is a remarkable and I think very beautiful sort of moral illustration of what that is about. So pollution means that what you thought, would like to think is outside, whether it's the smoke of somebody's cigarettes or what's coming out of an exhaust pipe, or coming out of a chimney, is not just there, but to your great distress, you learn that it's in your lungs. Inside, outside, just stop having the same kind of authority that we thought they had. And in a view like that, the thing that no one has is immunity. You can't be free from it. That whatever walls you have around you, whether they're walls of skin, Or walls of stone because you've sheltered yourself in a castle? Or walls of caste and money because you have privilege and you've moved away from where you think the evil is, or the filth, or the sickness? Dickens's book suggests, nope, can't get away. Can't get away. This is why the slum of the novel is the center of the novel. Tom All Alone's is the key character in the novel. That is why Joe is the exemplary orphan of the novel. He is the orphan, the agent, the emissary of Tom All Alone's. The slum is the center of the city. That is why these characters find their way back to it to die. It's where Lady Dedlock heads as if a magnet were pulling her back. The sick and the poor in this light, despite all of our logic, have the keys to the city. They are the ones who in fact have an influence on our lives. Now that may seem far-fetched, so I'll now read to you what I take to be perhaps the grandest passage in what is already a grand novel. And this is Dickens writing about the power of the slum, Tom All Alone's. But he has his revenge. This is the slum. Even the winds are his messengers, and they serve him in these hours of darkness. There is not a drop of Tom's corrupted blood but propagates infection and contagion somewhere. It shall pollute this very night the choice stream in which chemists on analysis would find the genuine nobility of a Norman house. In other words, it will go into some aristocratic house. And his grace shall not be able to say nay to the infamous alliance. There is not an atom of Tom's slime, not a cubic inch of any pestilential gas in which he lives, not one obscenity or degradation about him, not an ignorance, not a wickedness, not a brutality of his committing, but shall work its retribution. Through every order of society, up to the proudest of the proud, and to the highest of the high. Verily, what with tainting, plundering, and spoiling, Tom has his revenge. It is an absolutely stunning bravura piece of writing in which the moral, the political, and the medical are completely inseparable from each other. This is what I meant when I said the slum is the center of the city. You can ghettoize people as long as you want, but what Dickens is, and Dickens was a great student of hygiene, of urban hygiene, but you will not be able to fence it off because there are winds, because there is infection, because things move in the world. And so when the winds come, so too do the germs, so too does the infection and contagion. The great reality of infection and contagion is that we are not autonomous agents. We cannot fence off people. People have argued that this is so true for environmentalism. One of the first laws of it is that borders between countries mean nothing. That when Chernobyl first happened, it was in Scandinavia that they found out about it, because they detected it. It was not at first acknowledged by the Russians. And people who study environmental science will tell you that it makes a mockery of thinking that there are borders and lines and fences and defenses. If the winds move, so too does the disease. So too does the dirt and the filth. This is a world of interconnection. This is a world in which we cannot claim that we could ever have such a thing as immunity. And that's the way Dickens has written this book. That's why Dickens's books are populated with tons of different people, and tons is not much of an exaggeration. Bleak House is long enough to have a list of characters that outruns most Russian novels. It's unbelievable how many there are, and by the time you finish this book, if you had a great big spreadsheet, you could show how every one of them is connected to somebody else. That all of these people find, to their astonishment, they don't know it. No one is born knowing how they're connected like that. To their amazement, they find that they are brothered and sistered. That's what plot is in Dickens. That's the structure, not just of a novel, it's not an aesthetic concept. For Dickens, it would be the structure of life itself. So that's why the detective formula is so fascinating. Find out what's concealed, and you find out that everybody is intertwined with everybody. It's not incestuous as such. There are more ways to be connected. Money is one. Power is one. Disease is one. This book grafts the hidden, concealed, and denied connections between people who think that they are separate and independent. One of the most infamous scenes in the book is when Crook, K-R-O-O-K, whom I've not talked about, who has a rag and bone shop and is a possessor of secrets. He collects and steals and finds and gets people to give him all kinds of documents, mostly collections of letters and things like that. But he also has people's hair, people that are now dead. It's a strange, strange place he's got. Crook is illiterate. He cannot read. He's got bundles and bundles of letters that he cannot read. Crook dies in this book, and he has the most unusual death in all of literature. He dies of spontaneous combustion. Get that. Spontaneous combustion. The man explodes. And a lot of Dickens critics said, hey, wait a minute. I mean, just what can you really get away with? People don't explode. And Dickens was very testy about this. He always claimed that he had it on medical evidence, and he cites in one of his prefaces to the book several cases, one from Belgium, one from somewhere else, where somebody actually exploded. I gather that this thing is not physiologically impossible. But of course, it's not the physiology of it that's most interesting. We're not in medicine, we're in literature here. He dies of spontaneous combustion. His fluids run through the book. And it's interesting, the scene where this happens. It happens because two of the sleuths, this book is filled with sleuths. It's got real policemen. It's got Tulkinghorn, the lawyer, who's sniffing around to see what kind of secrets are there. And it's got Crook himself, who is a collector of secrets. And in this case, it's got two young people, one of whom is lodging at Crook's place to try to find out the letters that Crook is hiding, because they know that these letters say something about Esther Summerson's illegitimate birth as being the daughter of Lady Dedlock and Captain Hawdon. And these two young people, Guppy and Weevil, are in Crook's abode. They're trying to find Crook. And what they find, I quote here, is a thick yellow liquor. Or they find also a stagnant, sickening oil that covers his quarters. They find it on their hands. It's really a queasy sequence. It's like a vapor. It's like a dark, greasy coating. And they find it on the walls. And they find it on the ceiling. And they're trying to figure out, what is this viscous stuff that's all over the place? And they're looking for Crook. And finally, they see this crumpled form on the floor. And they realize that that is Crook. And that this oily stuff all over the place is also Crook. It's as if he has exploded and all of his fluids coat the setting, coat the scene. I want to suggest to you that those fluids seem to me to image the logic of Dickens' novel, that what would be inside, secret, hidden by our skin, explodes, gets into the environment, flows, is on people's hands as well as on walls and ceilings. Something is rotten in the state of Britain. This is a stunningly somatic scene, and Crook's death, with all of this oily, viscous stuff that covers everything, entitles us to think of this as some kind of urban pus. It's like lancing a boil. That this is the state of London. This is the diagnosis of the disease. These are the secrets that now have burst. And people in this book burst. When Rick finally finds out that Jarndyce versus Jarndyce is going to be come to a close, come to a settlement, and the settlement is that there is not one shilling left in it. It has all been spent by the lawyers. And Rick, whose life has been cued to this, opens his mouth to speak to the Lord Chancellor, and out comes blood, as if we were all a kind of collection of fluids that could explode in a moment of crisis. But a mouth full of blood is also a beautiful image, maybe not beautiful, queasy, threatening, but powerful image of language itself, because the mouth, you open it up, and those are words that are supposed to come out. And that's how I want to close this lecture. So much of what I have been focusing on is what is invisible to the eye. And the project of this book, and I'd like to say the project of great literature, of classic literature, of why we read, is to make those invisible connections visible, to bring them to language and legibility. And that is how this book closes. That language is what is ultimately being not exactly celebrated, but achieved in this novel. That is the purpose of art, to take what is unseen and everything that is crucial in life, all the things that connect us, that invade us, that form us are unseen, and to bring them to language. It's a noble achievement. Thank you.